Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Narayanam Namaskritya. Naram Chaiva Narottamam. Devim Sarasvatim Vyasam. Sato Jaya Mudiraye. Krista Prashabadeshu. Nityam Bhagavata Sevaya. Bhagavatyutama Shloke. Bhaktir Bhavati Naishtiki. Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, the fourth canto, text 26, text 22, and 23. That's text 23 on the board, so I will I'll read text 22, and then we can read the text 23. Paramo nugraho dando uti. I'll just read it as read Yesu Prabhu Hunarpita Balona Veda Tatvanti Pandi Tandi Bandhu Krityam Amarsana Parama Supreme Anugraha Mercy Danda Punishment Riteshu upon the servants. Prabhunda by the master. Arpita awarded. Bala foolish. Na does not. Veda no. Tat that. Bani O slender maiden. Bandhu Krityam the duty of a friend. Amarsana angry. My dear slender maiden, when a master chastises his servant, the servant should accept this as great mercy. One who becomes angry must be very foolish not to know that such is the duty of his friend. It is sometimes said that when a foolish man is instructed in something very nice, he generally cannot accept it. Indeed, he actually becomes angry. Such anger is compared to the poison of a serpent, for when a serpent is fed milk and bananas, its poison actually increases. You see why I haven't been here for 2 days. Oh. I didn't want to interrupt anyone else's classes, but my own class, I don't mind. But you're probably suffering. I'm sorry about that. Instead of becoming merciful or sober, the serpent increases its poisonous venom when fed nice foodstuffs. Similarly, when a fool is instructed, he does not rectify himself, but actually becomes angry. Prabhupada says, if you call a thief, he will say, why are you saying like that? No, I'm not a thief. You are a thief. You're wrong to say I am a thief. No one wants to admit their faults. They'll never admit to wrongdoing because they're justified in their minds. I took it, I stole it because he's rich and I am poor. And that's not fair or right. He's a bad person. I'm a good person. Why are you calling me a thief? They cannot define the word thief, so how can they understand other moral precepts? The purport is telling us that if you allow a thief to steal from you or from anyone else, he will become a bigger and more dangerous criminal. So this is our concern in management here, in India, in America, in governments throughout the world, either spiritual or mundane, that if someone misbehaves and he's left uncorrected, then that misbehavior will increase, will simply increase. We have in our society the obligation to protect a very wonderful philosophy. Our philosophy is based on love and trust. We accept from the guru because we love and we trust that person. We accept from our friends Krishna consciousness initially. We become Krishna conscious initially because we see someone who is giving us information about the proper way to act. He's possibly telling us, you have to give up this, you have to give up that sinful activity. At first, this is not palatable. But if one's intelligent, he can come to a conclusion, yes, it's not the right thing to do. The right thing to do is actually to relieve myself of all these material burdens and go back to Godhead. But that takes consideration, it takes time, and it takes energy, and it takes moral fiber. One actually has to have some concept of what is right and what is wrong. And to steal, that is wrong. So, we'll go on to this next text. Satvam Mukam Sudati Subru Anugraha Bara Satvam Mukam Sadi Subru Anugraha Bara. Vrida Vilamba Vilasa Dasitavalokam. Vrida Vilamba Vilasa Dasitavalokam. Nilakalibir Upaskritam Unasam Na Nilakalibir Upaks Ritam Unasam Na. Svanam Radarshaya Manashvini Valgu Vakyam. Svanam Pradarshaya Manasvini Valgu Vakyam. Satvam Mukam Sadi Suru Anugraha Bara. Vrida Vilamba Vilasad Darshitavalokam. Nilakalibir Upaskritam Unasamna. Svanam Pradarshaya Manasvini Valgu Vakyam. Satvam Mukam Sadi Surava Anugraha Mara. Vrida Vilamba Bara, loaded by Rida, feminine shyness, vilamba, hanging down, vilasat, shining, asita, smiling, avalokam, with glances, nila, bluish, nila, bluish, alaka, with hair, abhi, alibi, bee-like, upakshitam, thus being beautiful, gunasam, with raised nose, na, to me, svanam, who am yours, pradarshaya, please show, manasvini, O most thoughtful lady, valgu vakyam, with sweet words, my dear wife, your teeth are very beautifully set, and your attractive features make you appear very thoughtful. Kindly give up your anger. Be merciful upon me, and please smile upon me with loving attachment. When I see a smile on your beautiful face, and when I see your hair, which is as beautiful as the color blue, and see your raised nose and hear your sweet talk, you will become more beautiful to me, and thus attract me and oblige me. You are my most respected mistress. Repeating, my dear wife, your teeth are very beautiful. I'm sorry, very beautifully set. And your attractive features make you appear very thoughtful. Kindly give up your anger. Be merciful unto me. And please smile upon me with loving attachment. When I see a smile on your face, and when I see your hair, which is as beautiful as the color blue, and see your raised nose, and hear your sweet talk, you will become more beautiful to me, and thus attract me, and oblige me. You are my most respected mistress. Prabhupada says in the purport, an effeminate husband, simply being attracted by external beauty of his wife, tries to become her most obedient servant. We're remembering here that the wife is the intelligence. This is an allegory, but it seems to be a bit of a swing back and forth between allegory and reality. So we have to catch our balance on that swing sometimes. Sripad Sankaracharya has therefore advised that we not become attracted by a lump of flesh and blood. The story is told that at one time a man, very much attracted to a beautiful woman, wooed the woman in such a way that she devised a plan to show him the ingredients of her beauty. So you all know this play? Have you seen this play? They do this play, Liquid Beauty? Such a nice play. Such a nice play. Anyway, the woman made a date to see him. And before seeing him, she took a purgative. And that whole day and night, she simply passed stool, and she preserved that stool in a pot. The next night, when a man came to see her, she appeared very ugly and emaciated. When the man inquired from her about the woman whom he had had an engagement with, she replied, "I am that very woman." The man refused to believe her, not knowing that she had lost all her beauty due to the violent purgative that caused her to pass stool day and night. When the man began to argue with her, the woman said that she was not looking beautiful because she was separated from the ingredients of her beauty. When the man asked how she could be so separated, the woman said, come on, and I will show you. She then showed him the pot filled with liquid stool and vomit. Thus the man became aware that a beautiful woman is simply a lump of matter composed of blood, stool, urine, and similar other disgusting ingredients. This is the actual fact. But in a state of illusion, man becomes attracted by the illusory beauty and becomes a victim of Maya. So this is true both for the men and for the women. Everyone is attracted to these different lumps of flesh. King Purunjan begged his queen to return to her original beauty. He tried to revive her just as a living entity tries to revive his original consciousness. Krishna consciousness, which is very beautiful. That's our original consciousness, Krishna consciousness, which is very beautiful. All the beautiful features of the queen could be compared to the beautiful features of Krishna consciousness. When one returns to his original Krishna consciousness, he actually becomes steady and his life becomes successful. His life becomes successful when we return to our original Krishna consciousness. So this is our objective in Krishna consciousness, in ISKCON, to return to our original Krishna consciousness. There's no other objective, there's no other program for us. There's no political program or no financial program. There's no objective except to become Krishna conscious. So this is our primary goal. When one has goals in life, you go to these different seminars and they suggest, well, you write down all your goals and then you must prioritize what's the most important goal for you. And that priority, this is my first and most important goal, is to become Krishna conscious. But this is a guiding light for individual devotees. So many times devotees feel, I'm so worked, I have so many things to do and so forth. The primary thing one has to do is to become Krishna conscious. One may have a specific talent on the computer or in finances or in management or leadership. All of these things, very nice. These are karmically endowed talents. But Krishna consciousness is not a karmically endowed talent. There is a residual remembrance of Krishna that we never lose from one birth to another. If we become 1% Krishna conscious, we keep that from one birth to the next. If we're 90% Krishna conscious, we can say that person is very advanced. Still he has 10% to go. Still has 10% to make it. Full Krishna consciousness is the original position of the soul. And that is our objective, to return to that original state of consciousness. So we're acting in this way, and we're endeavoring for this goal to be reached, and it's our priority. So in order to make this reach this goal, certain things are necessary. Chanting of 16 rounds, hearing the Bhagavatam, reading, studying. These things should not be interfered with by a busy schedule. It should not be the most important. The most important thing is actually to become Krishna conscious. Sometimes one may be able to marathon his way through a through a large block of service, at the Christmas marathon or some book distribution and so forth. But one year I remember the devotees in Los Angeles, they had a very, very big marathon there. They go on for a whole month. So one devotee decided, I'm going to see if I can't chant my rounds, go to class, and go out at 9 o'clock in the morning after class. I'm going to see if I can't do this, my perfect sadhana, every morning, and then go out and see if I can't also do very, very well in the marathon. So this was a big distributor, and he was passionate. He had done many passionate marathons before. But this year he decided to put the priority on his sadhana, on hearing and chanting every morning. So he did this, and he came back in the mornings, in the evenings, in time to take rest and go to Mangalarti. He did these different things, and still he was number one. Still became number one. Because his priority was fixed on serving Krishna, because he desired to serve Krishna nicely, because he desired to, it may seem selfish, I'm going to put myself first, I'm going to work with my sadhana, I'm going to enjoy Krishna consciousness in these different activities. I'm going to do that first. It may seem selfish, but then he became the best servant. He became the best servant. He was able to distribute more books during the short period of time that he was out distributing because he was Krishna conscious, because he was fixed. So this is a lesson to all of us, no matter what our service is. If we take advantage, if we take advantage of the process that Srila Prabhupada has given us, then we can make great advancement, we can become excellent servants, and we can ultimately go back to Godhead. So we may think that this is a rather weird way to present Krishna consciousness, and this analogy of the stool, the lady and the stool. My wife, Ma Maya Dasi, she calls it the stool and urine philosophy. Her complaint was in the old days in New York, and everywhere, this story seemed to get worked into almost every class. Anyway, I don't know how many of you remember that, but it did. It seemed to come up quite often. And the objective is to have a real look at the body and see whether or not this is something that you want to spend a lot of time wooing, trying to attract. No lecture would be complete without referencing a beautiful woman and her stool and her urine. So a perennial brahmachari, sannyasi favorite, this was a point of their discussion. And the grihastha men followed suit. And as they had first-hand experience of this stool and urine reality, the essential material elements of a woman's body, as opposed to the essential spiritual element of a woman, the soul, was overdone in the not so advanced but good old days. So we had a perspective of, you could say, negative material. We didn't see that material things were used so nicely in Krishna's service. We saw instead that many things were to be rejected. But to many more effeminate males, Prabhupada calls them, and to the legally feminine women, in this stool in Yerman mentioned, was found to be objectionable. My wife didn't like it. So the question arose, should we preach like this to people? When people are just coming to Krishna consciousness, we preach heavily to them about the components of the body. And will people accept such a negative outlook as a gentlemanly or ladylike point of view? And probably not. People are spending billions of dollars on their bodies. For them, the body is me, the one and only self. I am my body. And I look good. Well, I don't look good, but other people might be thinking they look good. Anyway, I keep it in an attractive shape, and I don't want to hear about what's beneath my skin or my bladder or in my large intestine. The people are offended by this. Just as we pass stool and urine in private, to talk about it extensively, it's not very attractive. I mean, little kids, they enjoy talking about it. They think it's very funny. Great time. So generally people might think, well, we're like little kids. Christians are like little kids. But it's not the fact. It's almost like talking about death to talk about these things. And some people just simply cannot handle the idea of death. I met a man one day. I was preaching And this man, he agreed with me. Yes, you know, what we were talking about, I was talking about death. He said, he worked his way through college selling funeral plans. He said it was very lucrative because he would make $500 a night for a couple of hours going and selling someone a funeral plan, how to, you know, what kind of casket they would get and so forth. And so he was saying he had personal experiences. Some people would get so upset. They invited him in to talk about their funeral plans, but they'd get so upset with the idea that they were going to die and their body would be put in this box and the box would be put on the ground. They would get so upset that they'd just have to ask him to leave. So we don't want to hear anymore. Thank you. Please just go. So he wasn't talking about stool and urine. He was just talking about, you know, a nice casket with a silk lining, you know, which eventually, of course, becomes soiled with the bodily fluids. He wasn't talking about stool and urine, but he, you know, he's talking about the vault. You know, the vault is about that thick. It's a 9-inch cement walls, and you put that in the ground, and you put the metal casket in the ground, and you put the top over it. You know, you're safe. Your body is safe from atomic blasts and everything, you know, all these things. Some people, you know, in New York, I mean, in Los Angeles, they have special cemeteries where they pipe television into the casket so you can watch television when you're dead. And they have, of course, the pet cemeteries. It's a huge, extensive pet cemetery. Carnivore lived in L.A. for a long time, and he knows this, so did Ragavika. They have these incredible cemeteries in Los Angeles. At any rate, the idea was that people just couldn't face death. They just didn't want to know about it. They didn't want to hear about it. So those kind of people, we can say, they can't conceive of leaving their bodies. This is called max attachment, the maxi attachment, the full attachment, totally attached. So we're not going to make a lot of headway with those people. And perhaps rather than offend them, if they, you know, if they just turn their backs when we start talking about this body's lump of stool and urine, we just let them go. There's no point in chasing them, you know, insisting that we have the truth and they must listen to it. There's no point in trying to shove Krishna consciousness down anyone's throat. We look for, Vaisheshika was saying, we look for the mangoes that are low on the tree, the ones that are easy to reach. Don't try to climb the tree and get to the top mango. We go for the ones that are low on the tree. So we're creating a very nice facility here in Mayapur. Beautiful, incredibly huge temple and guest houses and so forth. We're preaching to those persons who want to know about Krishna consciousness. So we can take some liberty and we can speak very frankly about the nature of his body and its components. And it's interesting to think of these people, you know, they spend so much money and time preserving this body. They inject the body with formaldehyde, which means that this is basically a poison. They take all the blood out, put you on a table, and take all your blood out and return with formaldehyde, which is the embalming ingredient, which is a preservative, but it's also poison. It kills all of the organic growths that would normally start to rot the body and turn it into dust. So these bodies under these cemeteries are really preserved for thousands and thousands of years. Meanwhile, the occupant of the body, he's gone and taken birth in some factory farm as a chicken or a cow. You know, he's gone. And he's suffering like crazy. He's maybe watching TV. He may think, "Well, my body will watch TV. Very nice. You know, I'm gonna miss all my. I won't miss any of my favorite shows. You know, go to the retro channel and get all the old shows and so on." But all of this is hopeless. People don't understand the very basic fact of transmigration, that they're going to leave this body and take another body. And the thing that they should be concerned about is their karmic reactions. How are they going to dispel their karmic reactions themselves? Yeah, don't turn that off. There it is. Excuse me. How are they going to elevate themselves out of this repetition of samsara, this repetition of birth and death? So the body is a precious gem. It may be filled with stool and urine, but for a devotee, it's a precious gem. He has the mind and intelligence, the heart. He has opportunity to contact Krishna in the heart. He has the facility of intelligence to come to the proper conclusion that I am a servant of the Supreme Lord and I want to rejoin Him, and cultivate that desire by learning more about Krishna. These people who have misused their very precious opportunity is very unfortunate. They may be in a nice cemetery with grass and what they call perpetual care. They guarantee that cemetery will be maintained very nicely forever. But this is not the solution to life. I don't know where they get these philosophies. It's incredible, you know. It's a compilation of Egyptian ideas and so many different ideas that this body can be resurrected. In the Christian religion, they had a Council of Nicaea, and they decided they were going to argue about reincarnation versus a one-time shot at life. So, on the way to the council, all of the guys who were in favor of the one shot, which was basically Constantine's men. Constantine was the emperor at that time, and he was in the process of becoming a Christian. He wasn't baptized until a few days before he died, but he was in the process of using Christianity to spread his kingdom, because Christianity was very popular. So he tried to codify and put together all of the beliefs, the proper beliefs. So on the way to the council, the people who believed in the one shot killed the people who believed in reincarnation. They waylaid them on the roads, and so there was no real discussion there. But they included in the Nicene Creed, or what they call the Apostles' Creed, included this statement that I believe in the resurrection of the body. Which is curious, if you look at it from a Krishna conscious point of view, yes, you'll get another body. But you don't have to wait until Judgment Day. You don't have to wait for thousands of years until there's a big judgment, a cataclysm, the end of the world, and all the souls come up and they're either sent to hell or they go to the heavenly planets. You don't have to wait for that. That happens immediately after death. It happens immediately. You get your reactions very quickly. Prabhupada was asked why sometimes the people are in a coma. They're almost dead, but they're not dead. He was asked, why are they in a coma? Prabhupada said, well, the demigods are deciding their fate. It takes a little time by our reckoning, but by their reckoning, it's happening very quickly. This is Lord Brahma only stole the cows and calves for a moment, but by Earth time, it was a year. So like this, the demigods make a very quick decision where you're going. And if people understood this basic knowledge, they would be so relieved. Even if they had to go along with the concept of the stool and urine. Basically, our business is this stool and urine philosophy is a wake-up call. The fact that these bodies are not designed as pleasure machines, they are intended for self-realization and for getting the soul permanently out of the bodily conception of life, permanently out of material bodies altogether, out of what I call Bokul, B-C-O-L, Bokul, the bodily conception of life, trying to get out of Bokul. Our intelligence likened to the beautiful wife of Paranjan will revive and be happy if we become Krishna conscious. Certainly we can sugarcoat the philosophy if need be. A maha is the most mostly sugar-coated or loaded with sugar, and when people enjoy prasadam, we can preach and wake them up. It's a very nice thing. You can talk about many different things if people are satisfied, you know, and you can keep them satisfied by giving them nice prasadam. The fact is, these dirty, repulsive examples are necessary to understand we're not these bodies, especially to understand the real nature of the beauty of a young woman. Necessary because they give us a reality check, a reality perspective on the actual ingredients, temporary status of our so-called beauty, or are attractive to that beauty. one who has this perspective can make a rational choice as to his future ashram. If he makes the choice to live with a woman, at least he knows what he's getting into. We can remember that this philosophy of stool of urine goes back a long way. Prabhupada quoted Sankaracharya. But actually, I remember when reading Krishna book to my son, he was a little boy, he became very, very enlivened, tickled or found it very humorous. This particular passage, we read Krishna book. This is a wonderful, this is the talks between Krishna and Rukmini. And that's a very beautiful, as far as love story goes, it's a very beautiful story. How Krishna is teasing her, and then how she fades, and how he revives her, how he feels sorry, apologizes, and so forth. Very heart-rendering. At any rate, Rukmini recovers, as you remember, and she starts to talk to Krishna, negating all the things that he said. And she gets to this point. She says, in fact, superficially, the living entity is covered by this body, which is nothing but a bag of skin decorated with beards and mustaches, hairs on the body, nails on the fingers, and hairs on the head. Within this decorated bag, there are bunches of muscles, bundles of bones, and pools of blood, always mixed up with stool, urine, mucus, bile, and polluted air, and enjoyed by different kinds of insects and germs. A foolish woman accepts such a dead body as her husband, and in sheer misunderstanding loves him as her dear companion. This is only possible because such a woman has never tasted the ever blissful flavor of your lotus feet. But that's only one way to look at it. The current way to look at the phenomenon is why people bother to marry is based on hyper-romanticized, idealized fiction. In the Vedic culture, marriage is an obligation. Just as caring for and protecting your sister or your mother is a given obligation. It's also taking care of a wife is a regulatory obligation for those considered capable of maintaining such an obligation or managing such an obligation. It's almost like adopting a sister, but with a wife there's allowance for a conjugal relationship, of which the ultimate aim is to enjoy progeny, babies. But the wife in Vedic culture is an obligation, and as such, marriage is entered into with a sense of responsibility and duty. The sense of duty is far superior motivation than the sense of fantasy about how wonderful life will be when we are together. Why? Because it won't be so wonderful. It simply won't. There's a wonderful story about this. I don't know if I should tell this story or not. It's about the brahmachari who wanted to get married. I told you about this story. Have you heard this story before? It's a very funny story, actually. So anyway, it's told from the man's side, but I want to tell the women that it's the same attitude is there on the... I want to ask the women, actually, after I tell this story, if the same attitude is there on the women's side also. Okay. It may be only that the men are irresponsible about accepting the duties of marriage, but a brahmachari wanted to get married. And he was put off by his temple president and the board. In the old days, that's the way it was. You went to the board and said, I'd like to get married. And they suggested different women and so forth. They all warned him, oh no, don't get married. No, forget about it. Most of these guys were grihasthas themselves, so they had some experience. So he gave up the idea temporarily. But he came back after some time and was again put off. No, don't do it. Marriage is so hard. You're free now. Stay free. Prabhu, please stay free. So he gave up the idea again. But he came back and he pleaded, and this is how it was in some places in the early days. Anyway, so finally permission was granted. A nice woman was selected, the marriage took place, and shortly after the man, now a grihastha, came back to the temple president and the board, and he said, what did he say? Huh? He said, why didn't you guys tell me not to get married? So that was the standard. That was the standard at that time. It was a very funny story, guys. But anyway, so we discouraged the idea of marriage to the brahmachari. But to the grihastha-oriented men, the grihastha types, and there is a grihastha type, you can see the type here. So they have to get married. They should get married. But they should get married with the idea that I'm going to have a lot of responsibility. This is going to be a serious endeavor. And the wife also, although the women are expected to get married, they want to get married, and they need to get married, according to Prabhupada. The women also should take on the responsibility. It is not a light entertainment. It's not meant to be just for the honeymoon, for a few months. Okay. It's only for the brahmacharis. The grihastha types are still happy to be married. Anyway, the only civilized approach to these subjects is with a bit of humor. Because we're all suffering. Why humor? Because we're all suffering to some extent in our marriage or in our lack of marriage. We're suffering as a brahmachari, a grihastha, a vanaprastha, a sannyasi. Everyone is suffering. And if we're in the bodily conception of life, oh cool, all these ashrams are great and comfortable. But if we're not, I'm sorry, all these ashrams are great and comfortable if we're not in the bodily conception of life. So Bokul is my patented anagram, but no one's going to steal it. It's not very cool. It's Bokul. So the last comment about stealing your own philosophy, I cut and pasted the wrong place. Anyway, are there any questions or comments? Conflagrations? Cracks?
I have a question.
Yes.
Why is it that when brahmacharis go to preach, distribute books, book distribution in the world, they preach to women as living entities. But when these women or the ones in temple, they come to temple, they see them as Maya. How is that?
They see them as what? Mother?
As stool.
A stool in your...
Yeah. But in the Kami world, they preach to these girls, make them devotees, but when they become devotees, they see them as Maya. They don't talk to them again. Well, how is that?
That's only one of our many famous ISKCON paradoxes. So, part of our business as members of the society is to resolve the paradox. You know, if the paradox is bad, if it creates a bad situation, then we can resolve that paradox and change the attitude. But if the paradox, sometimes it seems strange, but it's good. Like Prabhupada said, he was asked how the devotee should be on Sankirtan. He said they should be like a lion on Sankirtan. When they come back to the temple, they should be like a mouse. They should be humble. There's an attitude of a salesman, if you know any salesmen or salespeople. It can be incredibly convincing and challenging and intense. You get you to sign on the line and pay the money. But then when they drop that persona, the salesman persona, and they have a different, shy, retiring nature. They say all salesmen are actually insecure, and they like to sell because it's a big thing, it's a big trip. I got somebody to do that, but most of the time, when they're not selling, they're just kind of very simple, quiet people. So like that, for the devotee, it may be necessary for him to preach to women on the street or outside the temple. And when they come, I think that he should acknowledge them, if he knows those people, should acknowledge them as a person he knows, and have in his mind, I'm a protector of this person. When he goes out, he's also a protector of that person. He's changing the direction of their life, so that they'd be protected from repeated birth, death, and old age and disease. He's changing them. He's protecting them by giving them knowledge. So when they come to the temple, he should also protect them and give them some, you know, welcome reception. But they should also learn, as the course of the time they're there, that I'm a brahmachari. If a brahmachari sees a woman he's preached to on the street, and she comes to the temple, I don't see there's a restriction. Maybe there is a restriction here, but he can go up and say, Hare Krishna, welcome. You know, this is the temple. And then he can talk with her a few minutes, preach, if he's preaching. And then he can say, you know, I'm a brahmachari, and I'm not really supposed to talk to women when I'm here in the temple. And she can either accept that or reject him. And he can go about, he can turn her over to a lady, or like that, or a grihastha. Or he can just say, I have to go now, I'm sorry. Without telling her he's a brahmachari, without giving her any information about that. Say, I have my schedule now, I have to be somewhere, I'm sorry. But please look around, do this. You know, there's so many gracious ways to conduct oneself. And that's what we're trying to learn as we progress, as our movement elevates itself, as we become more and more gentlemanly and ladylike, that we progress in certain ways. And one of those is social skills. If you go to someone's house and he says, I'm busy, please don't come in. But he receives you nicely, he gives you some water,